WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but
we have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I will guide you through this Indigenous Peoples Day show as we will do our best to keep you up to date and informed in so many different areas. That's what the idea of this radio program is we have all different types of topics that we talk about. They're not just necessarily political in nature, but they've arrived. You know, sometimes it varies. It could be political, as we do have a staple usually at the front of the show called the State House Report. We'll relax that. It'll be more of a county corner this week as the show kicks off with Greg Handley. He is a county commissioner, Plymouth County Commissioner, but now he has taken on a new role. He is the new Holbrook Town Administrator. We'll talk to him about all that he's accomplished as a county commissioner, as he will probably look to end his term. Not, I should say end his term, but probably finish his term. The question would be is whether or not he is going to seek re-election. But we'll also kind of get an idea as to how he was picked to be the town administrator and what some of the duties are. So we look forward to talking to him about that. Now, have you ever had questions about solar? Again, clean energy. You know, what do I do? Do I do solar? Do I do wind? Do I just stick with, you know, fossil fuel? Well, we're going to have a gentleman, Michael Wilcox. He is the co-founder of Elite Solar Advisors, and he'll join us and we'll talk about solar and what if I want to get involved and what are the particulars of solar. So we'll look forward to talking with Michael about that. Our number two, Casey Sherman, joins us, a return visit as we get updated on some of the many things that he is working on. Of course, Casey is a best-selling author, and he also has a podcast that we're going to chat a little bit about, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, produced, of course, by Mudhouse Media. We'll talk about that. Also, Casey has a new book that'll be coming out next year, The Untold Story of a Serial Murder on Cape Cod. And then after that, we'll close things out talking with Mr. Bill Richter. He is the founding artistic director for Pilgrim Festival Chorus, as they are going to be doing concerts to commemorate the Plymouth, the America's Hometown, Plymouth's 400. So it's a set of commemorative concerts that are going to be taking place. So we'll get to know Bill a little bit, and then we'll talk with him about the shows that are going to be coming up on October 23rd and 24th. Well, time for us to right now step aside just for a moment. We'll give you your final look at traffic. It's being brought to you on this end by Brennan Smoke Shop, online at brennansmokeshop.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now in Hudson, New Hampshire.
Well, thanks, Kevin. The expressway northbound is slow from Columbia Road to Southampton Street. Southbound's curling from the tunnel to Savin Hill. Route 3 North is heavy from Route 53 up past Derby Street. 93 North is crowded from Logan Express to the Braintree Split. Southbound is tied up from the split most of the way to Route 28. This report is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. At Whole Foods Market, get 20% off sustainable wild-caught previously frozen sockeye salmon fillets through October 12th while supplies last. Plus, Prime members get an extra 10% off. Traffic on the 9s every morning. I'm Lisa DeMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
Well, looky there. A grave digger digging a grave. Cave in. Ooh, Tori, the tree guy. Hope that tree doesn't fall in the wrong direction today. Sometimes I just like to sit on the hurricane barrier in New Bedford and watch the boats go out to sea. Fishermen, they're too easy. What's this? Oh, Brennan's Smoke Shop. 10 locations across the South Shore and South Coast, one on the border of New Hampshire. Who's responsible for these? Where is he? Jeffrey, where are you? Let's see. Major supplier of lung cancer, heart disease, and emphysema, not to mention cardiopulmonary. Well, I'm sure in this day and age, a lot of people wish this guy was gone. Well, I think he's great. See you next Halloween, Jeffrey.
Brennan's Smoke Shop. Customers must be 21 years of age or older, and proper ID is required.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
So we cruise into our first segment of your Indigenous Peoples Day here on 95.9 WATD. Of course, you're tuned into the one and only Monday Night Talk from Broadcast House. And our first guest as part of this conversation this evening is none other than one Greg Hanley. And what's fantastic is we're not here. We're here to talk a little bit about a transition of sorts that has happened in the past couple of weeks. And that is from being a Plymouth County official to where now he is working for the town of Holbrook. Greg, welcome back to the radio program, sir.
Good evening, Kevin, and good evening to your listeners.
How are you? How is your holiday weekend going?
So far, so good. The weather's been cooperative and enjoying all that life has to offer, Kevin.
So you and I have a long history, I think, from when you were serving the great town of Pembroke to when you decided to serve the county, Plymouth County to be exact, as a county commissioner. And so we're here to put in perspective of being a county commissioner. What has it been like for you to serve in that role? And not just as a county commissioner, you've also been the chair. You've received the gavel during your tenure as well.
Yeah, I mean, my political career obviously started way back when, coming out of the womb. I was a white Irish Catholic and Democrat, and we didn't have a choice. So my parents were very political when we were growing up, and we grew up in the city of Quincy. As you know, I was a city councilor there before moving to Pembroke right around 2003. So my extension of my public service continued in Pembroke as a town selectman and then on to the county in 2013. And it's been a great ride ever since.
So what do you feel are some of the things that you have been able to accomplish with other commissioners during your time serving the county?
Well, it really is a tale of two counties, to be honest with you. Day one, when I got into office, we had a $750,000 structural deficit, and we were selling property to pay one-time bills. And we found day one, Dan Pallotta and myself, along with Sandra Wright, that there was nowhere to go but up. But it took a lot of hard work, sweat, and determination, a lot of leadership decisions that got the county back on track. And if you look at from our tenure together from 2013 moving forward, we've turned the finances of the county around, and we got ourselves into a position where we could be relevant to the member communities. by providing different programming and services. Once we got stabilized with the finances, we were able to then create stabilization accounts and improve the bond rating. We took on programs like Plymouth County OPEB Trust, and we just started to do the business of the of what the county should have been all along.
Yeah, so to me, it sounds as though that the group that has been assembled, even as of late, is that you have found a way to reinvent yourself and show that, in fact, that a county government is relevant, even in this day and age.
Well, the adoption of the CARES Act actually returned the respectability of the county to the member communities. I think our decision, which wasn't an easy one to do, to take on CARES, has reaped a benefit and a dividend to the member communities. This was a program that was originally supposed to last a year that is now extended into 2 years. And as someone who's sitting in a different seat now, I can see conversely how the state is handling CARES and how the county is handling CARES. On the county side, because of the leadership of Tom O'Brien and the team we've assembled under the Plymouth County CARES Act, we are able to save communities processing time and cost associated with it to fulfill the obligation of reporting that's required by CARES. Conversely, in my new role, I'm finding that the state's guidance is onerous and costly and time-consuming for my team and my new position. And I have a tale of two cities there, but certainly in my role as county commissioner, with the leadership of Dan Pallotta and the help of Sandra Wright, we put that program together that continues in Dan's absence. And to the credit of Tom and his team, we've now parlayed that into the adoption of the American Rescue Plan Act. And instead of a go-it-alone strategy this time, our fellow counties have signed on to APA. Plymouth County just rolled out its APA program last week, and the other counties of Barnstable, Norfolk, and Bristol are rolling out their programs over the next 30 days.
So it's as though the Plymouth County has been the not only the beta test, but also has shown not only shown that it can repeat that success, and it's going to attempt to do with ARPA funding that it's going to get through the Biden administration.
Under CARES, we were eligible for $93 million, which we then distributed at the lowest cost in the nation per the amount received at a 0.08%. We've been nationally lauded by the White House for the performance of that. And that credit solely goes to Tom and his team and the team that he's assembled on behalf of the member communities. By saving that amount of money, we're able to return that to the member communities and maximize all of the money and all of the resources that we've gathered so that the member communities get the direct benefit. And that's something to be proud of. And not to mention the cost of reporting at this point. When you participate in the CARES Act under Plymouth County, you get soup to nuts from beginning to end, all of the processing and everything associated with us, where I'm finding now, to the contrary, that there's some extra requirements under the state program it's not a very pleasant thing in the town that I'm in now.
We look at politics, partisan politics, whether it's on state level, federal level. Talk to me about the success of being able to work with individuals who are not affiliated with your political party and still get things done, because it seems as though that's the one problem that sometimes state and most of the times federal government has problems with, is they can't get out of their own way because they're fighting amongst each other as to who's more relevant as a party.
Yeah, that is a hindrance to government in general, and it's caused a lot of a lot of angst amongst people who are in it with a high public service index to just serve. One thing we realized quickly in Plymouth County day one was that we're all in the foxhole together. And if we were going to come out of it alive, we had to rely on one another despite party affiliations. In the first 8 years that I was a county commissioner, I served with two Republicans, and Dan Pallotta and Sandra Wright. And I can count on my hand how many votes that were contrary to one another, maybe one or two, and they were probably deeper philosophical beliefs, and we respected one another. And that's the difference, you know, collegiality, respect, and common purpose. I mean, we had nowhere to go but up, but we needed to rely on each other and our different skill sets that we brought to the table to cobble together government and governance that was a benefit to the people we serve. And it was clear. I wish we could export that down to D.C. and get those folks to just recognize that we're all in this together. And I think pandemic, of all things, as a country, should have brought us together. But now they've politicized, you know, the remedies and critical of the solutions. And you know what? That's not helping any of us.
Just tuning in, we are speaking with Greg Hanley. Greg Hanley, who has stepped aside as Plymouth County Commissioner and has now taken on a new role in the town of Holbrook as their town administrator. How, if you will, talk to me about the opportunity. When did you realize the opportunity that Holbrook was looking for somebody, and when they realized that you were going to be the perfect fit for their community?
Well, for clarity, I did step down as chairman of the county commissioners. I'm still going to serve as a county commissioner, still living down in Plymouth, and will fulfill my term. An interesting story on how I got involved in this process. Troy Clarkson, former county administrator, current CFO for the city of Brockton, recommended that I enroll in a certified public managers program and work towards getting my master's in public administration. And while enrolled in Bridgewater State University, I found that as probably the oldest student in the room, that my life experience politically and professionally by either appointment or by election, my government service amounted to somewhere in the area that I could probably teach the class myself. But it was from a point of view, looking at how some of the things that I just learned by trial and error and by on-the-job training, it was apparent to me and apparent to some of my professors that a good opportunity for me to get to the next challenge in government would be to possibly consider a town administrator or a town manager's role. So I followed the advice of one Tony Macuzzo, who was my professor in a HR class that recommended that I consider myself to be a candidate. He is the town manager for the town of Norwood, and he introduced me a publication that I had when I was a selectman in the city council of the Mass Municipal Association, and there's where they post the openings for employment for different, you know, government bodies. And so I took a swing at it, put a resume together, and probably applied to four or five communities that, you know, I just probably didn't have the experience that they were looking for in certain areas. And last November, at the urging of a now passed away former selectman Rick McGahee, I threw my hat in the ring for consideration here in Holbrook. And they had undertaken a process of selection by an independent body comprised of the former Inspector General, Bob Sarasoli, former Randolph Town Manager, Dave Murphy, two selectmen, and the Deputy Director of E911 Services. And I was amongst a pool of 22 candidates that were whittled down to a candidate pool of six who were interviewed, and then down to a pool of three where we were interviewed and then rated as candidates without our names mentioned. And I was offered an opportunity to serve and was hired September 7th. And I've been working here ever since, just about a month now, a little over a month.
And just to make sure I clarify, is I know that you were still going to serve, but I didn't realize that you did step as the chair of the county commissioners, correct?
Yeah, the role of the county commissioner chairman, it was more of a full-time preoccupation, and I couldn't, you know, be masters to both without hurting the other. So at that point, with the leadership that we have in place, the fact that OPERA and CARES is up and running, Now it's just a mechanical function of the program where the leadership part of it wasn't as required. But the duties of signatures, my God, the amount of running around to sign paperwork to process is the role of the chairman. And I stepped down and Sandra Wright was elevated to chair. She had previously served. Mr. Valenzuela, who is also a member of the county commission, is the freshman, so to speak, has been assigned some roles and responsibilities in CARES and APA and in union negotiations, and his plate was full as well. So, you know, as a team, moved forward and just decided for the best interests of the member communities that I stepped down and serve one master, being the town of Holbrook.
What are you looking forward to in regards to taking on the duties as the town administrator? And what are some of the goals? What are some of the goals that you've set for yourself as you embrace this new position?
It's risk reward, Kevin. You know, I made a number of promises on deliverables that I would bring to the town of Holbrook. I gave them a 100-day plan that I would report back to them and address the town's needs right off the bat. Due to a number of vacancies, I needed to perform an audit and a review top to bottom of the organization. And along the way, I've discovered that there are more pressing needs and priorities and vacancies and management positions over here that are related to financial reporting. So to a degree, we've pivoted, but still with the idea of reporting back to the needs of the community. And we've been able to change the culture a little bit over here. Some of the stability issues are going to be addressed, hopefully, in the finance side of things. And then we can move on to, you know, building a better mousetrap here organizationally for the residents of the town, so we maximize our efficiencies and give them a good rate of return on their taxpayer dollar.
What has it been like engaging the community, being welcomed as, you know, the new town administrator, somebody who does, you know, a lot of the bidding for the municipality itself?
Well, you know, aside from the politics of the town, I think I've been well received by the department heads and the staff, at first with a little bit of skepticism, because you have to kind of prove yourself. And I would say now, with 1 month on the job, you know, department by department, we're you know, letting people believe in the mission of all ships pointing in the right direction. And it's a spirit of involvement. It's a spirit of inclusion. Previous to me, there was an interim situation that didn't really bode well for the future of the town. And I understand, because of COVID, that things were delayed. But now that they've cleared the way, it's incumbent upon me to deliver on what I promised. And it's a personal challenge because I have a lot to prove here. My name and reputation is all I walk in with. And I think I'll be judged. I'm actually on a probation status, so that I'm on an eight month probation period. Right now I have four selectmen, and the town needs five. There was a special election over the weekend that I'm awaiting the results for a fifth member. And I think once we have that leadership in place, with all I've been able to do so far, I think the town has a bright future, because I will say, as a community, the biggest asset for the town of Holbrook are its people, and in particular, its public employees. They're very, very dedicated.
Well, I still look forward to getting regular county updates from you, at least until your term expires in a couple of years, right? Because you're just relatively newly reelected.
I have some goals that I want to follow through on, one of them being the Plymouth County OPEB Trust. If we grow that membership, it only benefits the county, and therefore benefiting the cities and towns that are obligated for the other post-employment benefits of the past retirees.
Right.
That's a program that has been very successful, but gets more successful with the more people that you add. Of course, 4-H, we embarked upon carving out 18 acres of the farm. And this past year, with the help of Senator Patrick O'Connor, we were able to add a greenhouse to literally start the transition from individual community programs to a countywide, where we already had the resource. And you know, moving along, that that's a project that is really special, and working with the kids and helping them self-determine the future of the program. And that's something that I'd like to see through. And then we have the development of the 100 acres down at next to the jail. And we have other projects that have been ongoing that I hope to lend my experience to. And then once I've satisfied those goals, I can announce on your show today, Kevin, as an exclusive, that I will not run for re-election as a county commissioner. I think I've served the community to the best of my ability and look forward to what this job will bring me as the new town of Holbrook administrator.
Well, as always, we always appreciate having not only yourself on, but all the county commissioners, as we kind of have like a county corner. And that's what this has been today, is a bit of a county corner, but it's also kind of a transitional corner as well, as you are, you know, you'll still be in your position as a county commissioner, but you're going to be more so turning most of your focus towards your job as the town administrator in Holbrook. And we wish you the best of luck and look forward to updates as they become available.
Thank you. And I know the footprint of WATD and the groups that you're involved with on the cable side of things have a large footprint in this geography. And I look forward, as always, Kevin, with working with you to, you know, get the messages out that we need and give you updates as they're warranted. And I'm always available for you for any kind of commentary. So thank you for the opportunity.
You got there. He is Plymouth County Commissioner and now Holbrook Town Administrator Greg Hanley joining us for this segment. We're going to step aside just for a moment, but more of your Indigenous Peoples Day program here on 95.9 WATD. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McWiggin's Pub is an upscale Irish pub with all the class of a Boston pub. The menu offers favorites like steak tips, fish and chips, meatloaf, as well as burgers, sandwiches, and pizza. The relaxed, comfortable atmosphere at McWiggin's makes it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. New hours are Tuesday through Thursday, 4 to close, Friday through Sunday, 11:30 to close. McWiggin's Pub is at 546 Washington Street in Whitman, with the full menu available at McWigginspub.com.
Join Peter Evers for the Bamsey Buzz this Sunday morning at 11 here on 95.9 WATD.
I often think of coming to work at Bamsey as not necessarily coming to do a shift on a Thursday night, but to a place that cares about our employees' past, their present, and their future, and that we really want to invest in you, and you will invest in us.
That's the Bamsey Buzz this Sunday morning at 11 here on 95.9 WATD.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Thank you for staying with us for your Indigenous Peoples Day edition of Monday Night Talk. And in this particular segment, I thought it would be great to have someone in. You know, when you look at the traditional ways for us to get energy, it's usually whoever the local provider is. It so happens to be in the southeastern part of the Commonwealth. It's Eversource and National Grid. And I myself have been curious about solar and doing so, something that will be safe to my environment. So today joining us to talk a little bit about solar, and not only to help educate me, but to educate you, we have the co-founder of Elite Solar Advisors, Mr. Michael Wilcox, is my guest. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So if you will, I'm going to ask you right out of the box, what piqued your interest about solar and wanted you to invest in get not only the knowledge about solar, but helping other people who might be interested in this type of energy as well?
Yeah. So before this, I was studying nuclear engineering, and, you know, I've always been about clean energy. But, you know, what I saw is right now, solar energy is something that can help homeowners, not only in the short term, but in the long term as well. You know, it's something, the cost of it has gone down so much recently that people can save monthly on their bills. But once they own their system, they don't have to pay electricity anymore. They're saving thousands of dollars every year. And this is also something that helps, you know, meet our clean energy needs.
Is this, but is solar still something that's still relevant, or is it fighting it out for other clean energy resources such as wind? Is it right up there with wind, or is solar still something that is peaks and valleys above wind at this moment?
Well, right now for home and business owners, you know, installing a turbine is going to run them up, you know, a lot more money than installing solar on their own home. And also with the incentives that the local and federal governments give, it's, you know, it's a definitely a more cost effective solution for homeowners than going through wind.
Now, and was solar something that where it's been tried and true? Now you're talking about wind, where we're still, we're getting our feet under us in regards to doing, you know, if you're going to go out and buy, purchase a turbine and where to install it, and then you got to get permits, where solar is, would it be safe to say that it's more friendly these days to residential and business owners?
Yeah, of course. And there's a lot less limitations with solar than there would be with wind. All you really need is just to have sun on your roof versus having to live in a windy area for wind turbines to be effective.
Now, is everybody eligible to, let's say I call your company up and I want to know about solar, right?
Yeah.
Can every home be fitted for solar, or are there some homes that, you know, depending on where they are, maybe they're not eligible for solar?
You know, basically every home qualifies for solar. You really just need to be in direct sunlight. So if you have too many obstructions, you know, that might be something that would be difficult to work around, but, or maybe you could have homeowner association restrictions, but, you know, in Massachusetts, those aren't really a problem. You know, that's more down south, but, you know, it's available to everybody, and there's a lot of different options that can make it work.
So talk to me about, if someone was interested, is it, does it cost anybody for either yourself or a representative to come out and give a consultation on solar?
Consultations is completely free. What we would do is we would have one of our engineers design a system for your home. You know, if that's something that you want to move forward with, we could look at, you know, the cost effectiveness of it. We could see how much you would save every month, how much you'd save long term. But yeah, it's something that would be, you know, available to everybody.
So I have to ask you right out of the box, because it seems there are a number of solar companies that are out there. What makes your company different from everybody else?
Well, my associate and I, Devin Barbro, we founded this company because before we were working with, you know, all the big companies in the industry. We were working business development, you know, helping engineering firms partner with sales organizations, finding more sales partners, helping them expand geographically and increase their profitability. But through working with these companies, we saw that there were high pressure sales tactics. There were, you know, there was a lack of transparency with consumers, you know, not letting people know the actual true cost of going solar. And because we had all this whole network built already, you know, we had all the pieces in place to start a company and, you know, be able to outcompete everyone else.
So how about as far as cost efficiency? How is it cost efficient to do solar, to install solar? And how cost efficient is it if they were to go through your organization, Elite Solar Advisors?
Well, what makes it the most cost efficient is there's federal and state incentives. Right now, the federal incentive is 26% off of the system. It's a tax credit. Not only will it be credited towards your taxable income, it'll reduce it as well. In Massachusetts, they have what's called the SMART program. It's a bit tricky to explain, but pretty much you get credited for all the energy that you produce. So that will save homeowners several thousand dollars as well. But with our company, because we are working with all the major contractors that these larger organizations are working with, and we also do have the lowest bottom line cost because of what we were doing with them before, we're able to outcompete these larger organizations. We don't have this huge corporate structure where, you know, a portion of every sale has to go up the corporate chain, you know, fill somebody's pockets. It's, you know, it's the only cost is really just going to be, you know, for us and for our partners.
Okay. What is the process? Let's say I have the free consultation. I like what I'm hearing. What is the process when it comes to crafting a proposal? And is it that it's almost like going to a fast food restaurant where there's only, you know, you can either get a value meal A, value meal B, value meal C, or can you craft a proposal that is unique onto itself?
Every proposal is unique. Every home's different. Everyone has different energy needs. You know, what we really need is just to look at someone's energy bill from the past year. And what we do is we design a system to offset that amount, but also have the cost of that system cost less every month. So that way they can get their energy needs and they can also pay less every month for that system.
What is it like to be able to provide a service like this and be able to provide it at a lower cost? Again, that's the one thing that a lot of folks, you know, are priding themselves on, knowing that other costs are going up. If this is something that's going to help reduce their cost, that this is so good.
Well, I think something that a lot of people, you know, aren't really paying attention to is how just across the country, the switch to clean energy. In Massachusetts, they're looking to go 50% clean energy by 2030. But right now, the bulk load's carried by fossil fuels. And the reason being is that it's the cheapest. So while utilities switch over to clean energy, they're going to either have to produce more domestically or import it. But with that being said, the costs are going to go way up because they have to develop their own, or they're going to have to buy it elsewhere at a higher cost. This is why they're given these incentives. They're essentially paying homeowners to get solar because they need to switch to clean energy and they need the help of the people to do it as well.
The thing I would ask is, okay, so let's say I do purchase a system. Is there, with solar, what is the maintenance like? Again, if you do fossil fuels, you're heating with oil, you're going to have to do some sort of burner maintenance. Is there some kind of a maintenance that has to be done with your solar system? I don't know if it's a matter of cleaning panels or updating some of the electrical wiring.
Well, it does help to keep them clean. They'll function. They're warranted by the manufacturer to last 25 years. So, you know, they're guaranteed to last a while. It's, you know, just keep them clear of debris, make sure nothing that obstructs them. But, you know, they're pretty much maintenance free. They really don't need much attention. With upgrading to wiring, what people will need to have installed is what's called a breaker upgrade, which is whenever you produce energy, it'll tick backwards and count for the energy that you produce during the day. And this is called net metering, which is another way that people save money, because solar produces energy during the day while homeowners are at work. And when they come home at nighttime, they're using energy. What the solar panels do is they tick that meter backwards, so the energy that they use at night, it offsets that. So they are essentially using less from the grid, and that can either reduce the cost of their electricity bill or completely offset it. Some people can even have a negative balance, which they will get paid out by their utility company.
And if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Michael Wilcox. He's the co-founder of Elite Solar Advisors, and he's giving us a little bit of a tutorial here in regards to if there was an interest. I've thought about it as a homeowner that, yeah, maybe I might want to invest in solar, whether I would go 100% solar or maybe even look at a hybrid model. And that's a segue. Have you had customers who've discussed where maybe they want to go with a hybrid model? Maybe they'll still keep some form of electricity, but they also want to kind of dip their toe in the water with solar, where it's kind of a half and half? Or do you have people where they just, it's all the way?
Yeah, we actually have both. You know, like we were saying before, every system's custom designed. Now, people can opt in for a complete offset, but some people can also do a partial offset. Whereas, you know, you get a smaller system, it's going to be less of a cost. So that way, You know, it takes off some of their electricity bill, and that amount that is chipped off, they're paying less for those solar panels. So they're effectively still saving every month on their electricity costs. But, you know, sometimes it makes more financial sense for someone to do a partial offset rather than a complete offset.
How does New England weather affect solar? Now, I thought in the early days that if you did not have a day with sun, that you wouldn't collect as much solar energy. Is there always during the daytime an amount of solar energy that can be collected, or is it strictly if there's not a cloud in the sky?
Clouds, they will affect it just the smallest amount. It's not going to completely stop production. They will still produce, but it's not something that's going to make them not cost effective. It's, you know, the weather really doesn't hurt their cost effectiveness.
Okay. Anything that I haven't asked here, but you have, like, maybe you have a company generated frequently asked question or set of questions. What are some of the questions that you hear from folks who have come to your organization seeking assistance with putting together a solar plan?
Yeah. So there's one thing that people ask is, that they think that it might be something to hurt, the resale value of their house. But, you know, something that people can understand is how it increases their property value rather significantly. And also, too, it helps people sell their homes quicker. People are more likely to sell their homes. And studies have proven this with solar panels versus not having solar panels, because, it's more attractive for people to have free electricity when they get a house.
Now, if folks wanted to find out more information in regards to your organization, whether they want to go on a website, whether they want to check out your social media, how can they do that?
Well, they can visit our website, elitesolaradvisors.com. Right now, we're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're active, we post every day. And yeah, if they want to learn more information, we're always posting. Just about local incentives, how solar works, everything that they need to know about going solar. We have it on our website, have it on our social medias, and they can check us out there. That's elitesolaradvisors.com.
So I got to ask you a personal question, and that is that are you finding solar to be much more rewarding at this point than your studies in nuclear science?
Well, the thing is with nuclear engineering right now, with nuclear engineering, you're studying the reactors that use uranium, and they're in a transition period where they're going from these larger reactors to these smaller reactors. So right now, in the United States, they're shutting down more reactors than they are building. And they are looking by the end of the 2020s to install a new wave of reactors called SMRs, small modular reactors. Bill Gates actually has a company, TerraPower, which they're going to be installing one of the first systems over in Wisconsin. But, these are going to be towards the later 2020s. So, nuclear is definitely a good option for clean energy. It carries a lot of the bulk load. But the only problem is with its current state, it's we have to seek other options. So that's why right now with solar, its incentives that are higher than they're going to be in the future. So, if you're looking to switch to clean energy and also save money on your electricity bill, solar right now is just the best option.
It is funny that you had mentioned about the reactors shutting down because, here in Massachusetts, we had the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station that had recently come offline in the past couple of years because of how long it was running. And as you said, is they're seeking to have smaller plants than they had traditionally set up many, many years ago. Before you and I, of course, were thought of or considered. So anything you want to say in closing as we wrap up this segment? And again, just for folks who are just tuning in, we have been speaking with Michael Wilcox, who is the co-founder of Elite Solar Advisors. Anything you want to say in closing, Michael?
Well, I guess it's just it would be good for the people to understand just who we are. And we are just people who are advisors to people who are curious about solar. If somebody wants to know how it works, if it's cost effective, just what the benefits are in general, we walk them through the process. we can compare different quotes with different companies. You know, if someone says something that you maybe don't understand, if you've talked to somebody else about solar and, you know, you want to clarify a few points, you know, that's who we are. At the end of the day, we don't believe in high pressure sales tactics. I mean, if someone's going to give, you know, offer someone a better deal than we can, we would tell them to go with them. You know, it's just, we work with, you know, every major installer in the area. So it's, you know, we can offer some of the best systems, best rates. You know, we have some of the best manufacturing partners as well, multiple financing options. You know, we have pretty much every option available for someone who's looking to go solar. And, you know, we'd be happy to work with anybody who, you know, would be interested in learning more about it.
I know you gave out the website. I know you gave out the some of your social media information. How about an email address or a phone number if they wanted to reach out to you directly or the company?
Yeah, they can reach out to me directly. My phone number is 617-518-4691. And my email is michael@elitesolaradvisors.com.
Excellent. Michael, I want to thank you so much for being my guest and for better educating myself and my listeners on solar and their options today.
Hey, I appreciate you having me, Kevin.
You got it. All right. You have been tuned into Monday Night Talk. That does it for the first hour of Monday Night Talk. We are going to step aside for a brief break. But when we come back, we're going to speak with best-selling author Casey Sherman joins us right here at hour number two of Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
WATD-FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD, streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
You like my new car?
Well, I like that new car smell. What is that infernal binging?
Oh, it's part of the driver assist. Standard equipment nowadays.
Assist?
Yeah, watch.
Hey, cut that out. You're way too close.
Yeah, it's telling me that. See the text?
Watch out.
What was that?
You were driving too close. That truck snapped back a rock.
And now I have a cracked windshield?
You know, your mother was a way better driver assist.
Please. Kindly check your windshield.
I'm Peter Brown from Tiny & Sons Glass. We replace your windshield and insurance pays. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call. And thank you.
McGuigan's Pub is an upscale Irish pub with all the class of a Boston pub. The menu offers favorites like steak tips, fish and chips, meatloaf, as well as burgers, sandwiches, and pizza. The relaxed, comfortable atmosphere at McGuigan's makes it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. New hours are Tuesday through Thursday, 4 to close, Friday through Sunday, 11:30 to close. McGuigan's Pub is at 546 Washington Street in Whitman, with the full menu available at McGuigan'sPub.com.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Okay, welcome back for the second hour of Monday Night Talk, your Indigenous People Day edition of Monday Night Talk. And joining us is a good friend and somebody who, whenever we get together, we're able to have a conversation. There are multiple things that we can discuss because this gentleman and his partner, Dave Wedge, have so many things in the works, and they're things that are fantastic to dive into. We're talking about the one and only Casey Sherman, a best-selling author, award-winning author, who is joining us here now. Casey, thank you for having the conversation today.
No, it's always great to join you here on this show, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
I have to say, when I was sitting in Gillette Stadium just 8 days ago for the return of Tom Brady, I thought of you and Dave Wedge and your book, 12, the inside story about Tom Brady and his continuing fight for redemption. You, as a Patriots fan, as somebody who actually dug into what had happened during Deflategate, what was it like for you to see that, to kind of watch the game and all that was entailed in that particular match?
Well, it, you know, it was the culmination of everything that we had written about a couple of years before. As you mentioned, 12, the New York Times bestselling book that we wrote about Tom Brady and Deflategate, really predicted the bitter divorce, if you will, between Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. We were the first people to write about it. And, you know, that coverage and the news reporting that we had done at the time, you know, led ESPN's coverage for almost a week. And here, you know, fast forward to 2021, and you're seeing these two great, you know, legendary figures in the NFL on the opposite side of you know, of the field, which is really unusual to see. And it was interesting. You know, you're rooting for the Patriots on one hand, but you're also wanting Tom Brady to do what Tom Brady does, which is, you know, elevate his play. And it's like watching Muhammad Ali or Michael Jordan, you know, in their primes. You know, this is something you won't see again. So it was really a treat for me to watch personally.
You're disappointed by the outcome?
Am I? No. I think that I'm disappointed that, you know, Bill Belichick jettisoned the greatest player in NFL history long before he should have. I think it's it was a huge mistake. I wrote about it at the time. I think that, you know, Bill Belichick's legacy will be tarnished because I don't think he'll ever get back to the mountaintop. And it could have been so very easily for him to do that had he kept Tom Brady on the team, had he surrounded Brady with, you know, talent that would get them to the next level. And don't forget Rob Gronkowski. Here's a guy that retired because he didn't want to play for Bill Belichick. So, you know, look at what Gronk did when he came back to help Tom Brady win the Super Bowl in Tampa. You know, those victories should be New England's victories, but they're not. And there's one person that's ultimately responsible for that, and that is Bill Belichick, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's just interesting to note that while the Patriots won 6 Super Bowls with Tom Brady at the helm, they went to 2 others. While they were not successful with the W, they still went to 8 Super Bowls. That is unheard of in this era.
No, it's unheard of in any era. You'll never see it again. And, you know, one of the things we updated our book 12 last year for a new paperback edition. And we wrote about Brady going down to Tampa. We found out exclusively that Bill Belichick, you know, was hoping to move Tom Brady during the 2017 season to the San Francisco 49ers. And he was not allowed to do that because Bob Kraft ultimately stepped in. So Bill Belichick, you know, being the, you know, kind of the, I would say the arrogant and childish in many ways, GM sent Jimmy Garoppolo to the 49ers for a second round draft pick. So, you know, this is kind of what, you know, the man behind the hoodie is all about. He preaches, you know, the Patriot way and everybody working together, but his actions speak louder than his words.
And it's also interesting that you talk about the book coming out on paperback. And I just want to implore folks, if you are going to get the hardcover of the paperback, if you're also a fan of audiobooks, this and many of Casey's titles are available as audiobooks. So if you like all those dynamics, if you're not able to read while you're driving somewhere, you can pop in an audiobook and you could get 12, the inside story of Tom Brady's fight for redemption and other titles, which myself, I have bought and listened to on a regular basis. And it's great to be able to listen to them over and over and over again. So just want to throw a plug in for the audio.
No, I appreciate that.
And while we're talking audio, and it's a nice little transition, we could talk a little bit about you and Dave, as you have a podcast called Saints, Sinners and Serial Killers. Sounds like a band name. I love it. Produced by Mudhouse Media, and I believe you have a good friend of mine, Mike Joshua, as one of your producers over there.
Yeah, Mike Josh is an incredibly talented producer and really, you know, brings to life all of the investigations and the writings that Dave and I have been a part of for 20 years. And you mentioned the audiobooks. And when we were, you know, we were leery and reluctant to get into the podcast space, especially that true crime space, Kevin, because there were so many true crime podcasts out there, and we didn't think any of them had the authenticity that was really needed. Basically, you know, these podcasts are filled with a lot of armchair amateur sleuths who, you know, talk about true crime. We didn't want to do that because of our experience, you know, at crime scenes and investigating, you know, real cases. We wanted to create an immersive podcast where we're bringing the listener into some of these very difficult and hair-raising experiences that we've been involved in. So when you think about the audiobooks, we condense a lot of our material for these, you know, 15 to 20 minute podcasts that are really, you know, put you on the edge of your seat.
So what are some of the latest episodes that have been crafted that listeners can be in store for?
Well, season two opened earlier in September, and we opened with a three-story arc based on my book, Animal, which is about Joe Barboza, the first man ever placed in the witness protection program. And, you know, unlike the book, what we can do in a podcast, Kevin, is we can provide certain audio clips. You're hearing for the first time Joe the Animal Barboza in his own words. You're hearing Frank Sinatra, who is railing against being implicated into the mafia back in the 1970s. So it's just really enjoyable and interesting. And obviously the stakes are very high, especially in those episodes, because you're talking about gangland murders. You're talking about car bombings. But at the end of the day, you're also talking about the largest monetary settlement in the history of the U.S. Justice Department. And that was because of a murder that happened right here in New England.
No, some of your podcasts, while they predominantly are true crime, I believe that some of your podcasts, you will take a break. You will kind of, depending on if there's a timely topic, expand it. I think you had like Margaret Cho on at one point in time in your last season.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's another fun thing to do. And, you know, I've learned a lot from you as an interviewer, Kevin, quite frankly, in terms of bringing these live guests on, like Margaret Cho and a few other people that we've talked to, other authors who have written, you know, true crime books. We had Casey Sepp on in season one, and, you know, they're all easily downloadable for free, so everybody can catch up on season one and season two. And Casey Sepp wrote a book called The Furious Hours, which is about Harper Lee's last investigation. She was trying to write a book about a serial murder case that was happening in Alabama and Mississippi. And a lot of it is about her life at the end of her writing career and this absolutely outlandish murder case that I'd never heard of before. So it's always interesting to bring on, you know, new people that have different insights than your own.
I'm fascinated with how busy both you and Dave are, you especially, with all that you do, because you do have your own production company as well.
That's right. You know, Dave and I started a production company called Fort Point Media a couple of years ago, and we have now several different television and film projects in various stages of development right now. And we're really excited about that. We created the company, Kevin, after Patriots Day, because we were involved in Patriots Day. The movie was based on our book. I had previously written, as you know, The Finest Hours, which also became a big Walt Disney film in 2016. And we were really captivated by the Hollywood process. And because, you know, we're pretty prolific in our writing, we wanted to make sure that if we were selling our material to Hollywood, that we would have a say at the end of the day in terms of how these productions would unfold. So we wanted a seat at the table. We created our own production company in order to do that. And off we go.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Casey Sherman, author, producer, extraordinaire. And we're talking about the many different projects and things that he has in the works. And then we're currently talking a little bit about the podcast, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. And this, again, produced by Mudhouse Media. What are some of the other podcasts that the folks can anticipate in the coming weeks that you have in the works currently?
Sure. Well, we do have two Tom Brady episodes that people can listen to right now, and it really brings you into the legal drama that really enveloped Brady during the Deflategate. And again, that's not ancient history, because that is really the impetus of why Brady is in Tampa Bay right now. So people can really understand how the NFL really went after this guy, and how he was betrayed by his own coach, and in some respects by the owner of the Patriots, Robert Kraft, even though their relationship has been repaired over time. We also have two episodes up that really focus on the Me Too movement, but in a different way. It's one of the biggest scandals to ever rock the hip-hop community, and Dave is a big writer in that space, and those episodes are pretty shocking. The fact that there are predators of young men who have gone without any acknowledgement to their crimes. So those are stories that, you know, we feel a responsibility to tell. We'll also be writing a little bit about, you know, a 17th century crime in terms of the Whydah pirate ship. Now, Kevin, as you know, I've been involved with the Whydah expedition team for some time now. And if anybody doesn't know, the Whydah is the only authenticated pirate wreck that's ever been discovered anywhere in the world. And it was discovered right off of Cape Cod. And I got involved with the explorer, the famed explorer, Barry Clifford, several years ago, because not only has Barry unearthed over $100 million in gold and silver from that wreck, but they began to unearth human remains too, Kevin, human remains of the pirates themselves. So when I joined the team, my task was to find out who these bones belong to. And the only way to do that, of course, was through, you know, DNA testing. So I brought in the University of New Haven in Connecticut, which is the, you know, premier forensic college in the United States, to test these bones of these pirates. And then I had to go to England, a little small town in England where the pirate captain was born, to get DNA from his bloodline relatives. So it's a really interesting story that begins in 1717, but brings you up to date to 2021.
How exciting is something like that, where there's so much that can be gleaned from not only someone unearthing all this historical artifacts, but then kind of going on the trail to track down someone in this individual's bloodline, and to be able to tell a story.
Well, that's the part of the job that I really enjoy the best. Yep. Kevin, quite frankly, is being boots on the ground, doing the research, meeting people, understanding history through a different lens. Certainly, you know, the Whydah story is, I've been fascinated about it since I was a kid, and to have the opportunity to, you know, follow in Captain Black Sam Bellamy's footsteps and to go to his little home village in Devonshire, England, to be standing in the church where he had been christened in the late 1600s and where his mother is buried in an unmarked grave right behind there because she died during childbirth. It brings that history into focus and makes it real.
Wow. That is definitely fantastic. You talk about the art of, you know, relishing the art of writing, and you might want to take a moment to talk to us about your newest book, Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Murder on Cape Cod.
Well, Kevin, we're really excited about this project. The book comes out in 2022, but I'm currently working with Robert Downey Jr. and his production company to adapt the book for a limited series for television. The story itself is a prelude to the Charles Manson murder case. In 1969, you had a serial killer on Cape Cod luring young women into darkened woods, not only to kill them, Kevin, but to dismember their bodies and bury them in shallow graves. Now, I've been involved in probably 100 homicide cases during my career as a journalist. I've never seen anything like this before. Getting a hold of the autopsy photos and the crime scene reports was incredibly chilling and certainly has keeping me up at night. My way into this story, Kevin, is the literary way in, because Kurt Vonnegut Jr. and Norman Mailer, two titans in the literary circles, they became obsessed with this serial murder case on Cape Cod in 1969. So part of the story is a true crime narrative about the murders themselves, and part of the story is about this rivalry between these two giants in American literature.
But basically, it sounds like you're sharing two different timelines, not only these two individuals who are trying to get the story right, but also giving the what was taking place with the investigation itself.
Exactly. So, right. You know, you're circling, you're focusing a little bit on, obviously, the killer and the detectives that chased him down. And then you're focusing on these two men at different stages in their literary careers. Norman Mailer at the time was a household name. Kurt Vonnegut hadn't published Slaughterhouse-Five yet. So he was living on Cape Cod and really thought of himself as a failure as a writer. And Slaughterhouse-Five obviously changed all of that, but he became immersed and obsessed with this serial murder case. And then they really wanted to outdo each other in terms of writing about it first and getting the story right. So it's a fascinating story for me to write. I really, you know, jumped in with both feet in terms of learning more about their careers, because I'm a big fan of both writers, but also weaving in, you know, the criminal elements that I've been so good at for so long.
What kind of a challenge did this pose to you as a writer, having these two different timelines or these different elements to write about and bring together into one book?
Well, I because they were really kind of happening at the same time, it's very natural to write, you know, go back and forth in the narrative. And, you know, I'm a pretty visual storyteller. And as you know, Kevin, any book I write, I don't want to write a dense, you know, criminal procedural. I want to tell a story. Right. And I think that this story really lended itself to that narrative storytelling that almost reads, you know, like, you know, it's fiction. And I had to incorporate some fictional elements into this story as a nod to both Vonnegut and Mailer. So it's a gripping read. It'll be a gripping television series as well. And I can't wait for people to read it. It's something that, you know, challenged me as an author and a writer. And, you know, I hope it pays off.
Now, is this a book that I know that you have teamed up with other writers in the past? So this is something that you've also written books on your own. Was it refreshing to kind of be able to do it on your own? It kind of gives you an opportunity to explore just on your own as you're writing this?
Oh, of course. You know, I have a great partnership with Dave Wedge. And, you know, I also wrote The Finest Hours with Michael Togas.
Yep.
But as you mentioned, I've written a lot of books on my own as well. So this offered me, you know, just the freedom to just go about it at my own pace and really take the story, you know, down certain dark alleys that that I could without having to, you know, debate my co-authors or work, you know, simultaneously with them. Dave Wedge has just finished his first solo project, which is he's very excited about, and I'm sure he'll come in to talk about that eventually as well. So it's refreshing to do some solo projects and then get back as a team. Dave and I are working on a new book right now about Kabul International Airport, but it's not the massacre and the deadly shootings or bombings that we saw a couple of months ago. This is a story that takes place in 2011. It's gripping, it's chilling, and it'll probably, in our estimation, lead to a major investigation at the Pentagon.
What's it like to see your partner explore and do his own project and write his own book? Again, I feel that you guys are more than just a team. You guys, it's almost like a brotherhood between the two of them.
Oh yeah, I'm very you know, I'm very impressed with Dave, and you know, I'm pleased to see that you know, he went out on his own to really tackle this story, you know, from cradle to grave. You know, because I've written 15 books, you know, I really can dictate the narrative of a story over 200 to 300 pages, and you know, the way I explain it to people, Kevin, is, you know, I can just sit down at the piano and just play now. You know, I don't need to map anything out ahead of time. I've done it for so long and you know, at such a high rate of speed that it comes easy to me. Dave's never had the opportunity to do that. So he's done this with this particular project. I can't wait to read the completed manuscript, and I think it's going to be great.
But you had mentioned about you with Helltown that this is being developed with, you know, for TV with Robert Downey Jr. I mean, who is over the past 10 years become a massive, you know, figure in Hollywood. How cool is that?
That's very cool. It's surreal to, you know, work with his production company, which is run by his wife, Susan, and she's brilliant. But they're excited about it. And Robert Downey Jr. mentioned in one of the earlier conversations that he had actually met Kurt Vonnegut on the set of Back to School, which was a Rodney Dangerfield comedy in the 1980s. Right. Robert Downey Jr. co-starred in that movie, and Kurt Vonnegut had a cameo role in that movie. So that, you know, he was intrigued by that because he had a chance to meet Vonnegut at some certain stage in his career. So, but to work with, you know, brilliant people like that is just it's amazingly fortunate, you know, in my career with the people that I've collaborated with.
And if you could just, I know I kind of teased it as being a book that's being released next year, Helltown. When can we find it on the shelves of bookstores next year?
July 2022. It is a bit of a wait, but when you're sitting on the beach next summer, you can be thankful that you'll have a great, gripping, terrifying read to enjoy while you're working on your suntan.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of your books being recognized as a New York Times bestseller. I believe this might be your fifth book that has been deemed this. The Last Days of John Lennon, a book that you did with Casey Sherman and James Patterson. Talk to me about, you know, being recognized and the by this prestigious, you know, list.
Well, it's amazing, Kevin. You know, I was a kid who grew up in Hyannis on the Cape. I never thought I'd be a writer someday. And to have, you know, now my fifth New York Times bestseller, which is about, you know, the last days of John Lennon's life and obviously the tragedy that befell him on December 8th, 1980. But we, you know, that book itself is really a tribute to John. And, you know, the research we mentioned earlier, you know, the being boots on the ground and really, you know, going undercover, if you will, to find new stories about these celebrated figures. That's what I take, you know, from my experience with that project. You know, being a New York Times bestseller for the fifth time is amazing. But, you know, being able to interview Paul McCartney for that project and some of the other people that we interviewed and met along the way, those are the things that'll stay with us for the rest of our careers.
Well, congratulations to you, Dave and James, and you specifically for the recognition of a fifth book being, you know, recognized by the bestseller list. One last thing, piece of business before we wrap up our conversation here. I thought I saw an interesting tidbit, you teaming up with another true crimes author, Hank Phillippe Ryan. Are you doing some special event with Hank?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, Kevin. We are we're hosting a storytelling competition at Chatham Bars Inn in late January of early next year. And basically, if anybody's watched The Voice or American Idol, we're going to do the same thing for writers and screenwriters, where we're going to be judging writers on their merit. And then if they win that competition, we will work with them for an entire year on their books or their screenplays and work with them to get them produced into film or television and get them published with a major publishing house. So it's an exciting thing to be a part of. And it's all about paying it forward, Kevin, and, you know, trying to provide opportunities for writers like myself. I know when I was a young writer and scratching and clawing for recognition, I wished I had an opportunity to do something like this.
Where did that concept come from? Because I think that's a phenomenal concept.
Well, again, you know, I steal from the best. So, you know, my wife and I were watching The Voice one night. I thought, hey, you know what? I can translate this into something else, because writers and screenwriters, you know, deserve an opportunity to get their work heard, you know, from outside experts. Like you mentioned, Hank Phillippe Ryan, who's not only a great writer, but a good friend of mine. And I knew she'd be an incredible mentor to some of these, you know, aspiring writers who want to get their work out there.
Yeah, you're correct. So she's written some great books, and let's not forget, I think she's still an investigative reporter for one of the Boston TV stations. You know, still staying busy, just like yourself.
Yeah, she's an amazing force and really sweet and kind and just great to be around. So anytime you can get together with your friends and try to do something good for someone, I'm all for it.
Casey, I want to thank you for your time and sharing an update with all that you do. If folks want to find out more about what you're working on, releases of books, podcasts, do you have a website or social media? Sure.
Yeah, they can follow me on Twitter, Casey Sherman 123, and they can go to our website, fourpointmedia.com, to be, catch up on all of the different film and television projects. And our podcast, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, is available on all podcast platforms.
And as we wrap up and we say goodbye, I want to finally say to you, congratulations on your recent nuptials. In life, it's sometimes we come in it alone, but if you can find somebody that you can enjoy life with, it makes life that much sweeter.
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head, Kevin, and I'm a lucky man.
Well, I want to thank you for being my guest on this radio program today. And as always, and we look forward to your next update.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks, guys.
You got it. We're going to step aside. And when we come back, the final segment of Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about 1 out of 2 men and 1 out of 3 women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced Cancer Care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally, with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
McGuigan's Pub is an upscale Irish pub with all the class of a Boston pub. The menu offers favorites like steak tips, fish and chips, meatloaf, as well as burgers, sandwiches, and pizza. The relaxed, comfortable atmosphere at McGuigan's makes it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. New hours are Tuesday through Thursday, 4 to close, Friday through Sunday, 11:30 to close. McGuigan's Pub is at 546 Washington Street in Whitman, with the full menu available at McGuigan'sPub.com.
Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back. We return for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. And we have yet another great guest. We are going to talk about yet another event that is commemorating America's hometown, the birthday. Well, I mean, the birthday was 2020. I know we're in 2021. But joining us right now is the founding artistic director and conductor of the Pilgrim Festival Chorus. We have Mr. William Richter. Bill, welcome to Monday Night Talk, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I will say is something about the arts that I've always been fascinated about, and that always there's a spot carved in this radio program for. This is my second, I would say, chorus or choral group that I've had on. We've had the folks from the Jubilate Chorale up in Brockton.
They're wonderful.
Yeah, and usually when they are on, it's more around the holidays.
Sure.
So that this is real good that we're able to talk about this. If you will, let's give a little bit of a history lesson to the listeners in regards to the Pilgrim Festival Chorus. How did this organization form? How did this come to be?
Well, it started about, it would be 21 years ago, that a large number of people, we had a choral festival, which was just like choirs from all the churches in Plymouth that would get together, and we'd sing for each other, and it was really a wonderful event, and we did that for many years. And at the end of one, we said, you know, we should all get together and make a chorus. And so after some deliberation, the group was formed. Elizabeth Chapman Riley agreed to be our accompanist, and I agreed to be the director, and we had 108 singers at our first rehearsal, and it was really the start of something which was really huge. And what I mean by that is that simply there were so many enthusiastic singers that we knew it was going to be something really great.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What is it about music? I mean, is this something that you went to school to be someone who understood how to direct and lead a group of folks, either vocally or with instruments?
Well, I grew up on the South Shore here, and I went to college for music education, which means that I was interested in becoming a music teacher. And I've been at Scituate High School for 39 years now as the choral director there, and 7 years prior to that at other school systems. So I'm in year number 46 of teaching, and I love every minute of it. I've never been to work yet. I have yet to actually go to work. So my draw to this is simply because there, for a lot of people, there's a lot that you know, they can see beauty in so many things, particularly in the arts. They can see beauty in painting, in movies, in theater, in Broadway, in all kinds of things. The beauty for me on this planet is really greatest in the sound of human voices in harmony. And so I direct 9 choirs, 5 at Scituate High School, and then I directed the Pilgrim Festival Chorus, Pilgrim Festival Singers. I have a church choir. I go to work in my hobby.
It's interesting. When I think back to all the teachers I had growing up, there is one teacher who stands highest amongst all of them. It was a music teacher in 7th grade, Mr. Chapman at North Junior High in Brockton.
Oh, my gosh.
A fantastic man. Who was the teacher for you that led you down this path for music? That you're like, oh, you know what? That guy looks like he's having fun. That individual looks like they are enjoying what they're doing, and it's not a job.
Right. And the funny part is that I didn't really have great music educators in my upbringing. They were good people, but not necessarily great educators. But for me, it was the education that I got at the Boston Conservatory and at BU and at Westminster Choir College and other places where I learned that there's something greater that you can bring to standing in front of a group of people and everybody working together, 60, 70, 80 people working in unison to create beauty. And that's something that, you know, we all go to our jobs and we're individual at what we do, but this is a collective thing. So a big part of what I do is creating the community of singers.
So we kind of gave a little bit of a history of the Pilgrim Festival Chorus. Could anybody be a part of this? Is this a volunteer organization if someone has the chops?
Basically, we accept everybody that walks through the door because we want to be able to make it be as accessible as possible. Of course, we have lots of people who are professional musicians. We have people who are music teachers. We have people who have years and years and years of choral experience singing at Carnegie Hall and all kinds of things like that. And we have people who are coming to it pretty early on, and that is also another part of the beauty of it, is that there are people from a whole bunch of different backgrounds that all have one thing in mind, and they realize that it's largely about the music, it's also about the community, it's also about the group of people that get together every Monday night, even when they could be at home watching sitcoms. I don't understand. Personally, I don't really understand why they would want to be with me for 2 hours while I beat the heck out of them. but it really does work well.
But I would probably ask you what we all have our stories in regards to how we have dealt with the pandemic. What has it been like for yourself and for some of the folks who are part of your group? How did you guys endure the pandemic?
Well, on a number of different levels. I mean, financially, there weren't any costs, and so the group is really doing very well, or at least is surviving in that way. The hardest part was because we lost the community and we lost our music, and so we lost also our opportunity to give public performances. As you I'm sure you know, choral singing, because of that chorus in Washington State where two-thirds of the group got sick and a couple people died. Right from the beginning of the pandemic, choral singing, because because you're breathing so heavy and you're singing really loud, you expend a whole lot more aerosol than any other activity. Although I would say that the wrestling team at my school probably expends the same amount of and they wrestled all the way through the pandemic, but that's okay. But I think the hardest part for us was loss of the community and loss of our music.
Were you able to still do things virtually? Did you attempt to stay in connect with your volunteers?
Absolutely. And so, you know, when life deals you lemons, you make lemonade. And we did a virtual performance, and that adds another whole level of difficulty to it, because we're not in person. Teaching the music is really, really hard. And then each individual is expected to make their own recording, and their own recording might not meet their own standards. And so some people said, I can't do this. It's too hard, or the technology's too hard. But we had a lovely performance of one piece. It was a piece called Oh Love by Elaine Hagenberg. And you can see that on our website.
You're just tuning in. We are speaking with Bill Richter. He is the founding artistic director and conductor of the Pilgrim Festival Chorus. And we're talking about the chorus getting ready to take to the stage later this month. I believe it's a program called Pilgrim Journey, Songs of Faith and Courage. I believe there are two shows, October 23rd, October 24th. One of them is at 7:30 p.m. The other is more of a matinee of four. This will be at the St. Bonaventure Parish. This is at 803 State Road in Plymouth. So I have to ask, when was the decision made to commemorate the Plymouth 400th and do it with a show like this?
Long ago. Actually, this has been a long time in coming. But of course, we could not perform last year, and this would have been a performance that we would have done last fall. But the interesting part about this is the music of the Pilgrims really was non-existent. And one thing that they did was they would line out psalms, and what that means is one person would sing a line of a song. Praise God for whom all blessings flow. The congregation would sing back, praise God for whom all blessings. They lined out things. It was all in unison. There really wasn't any sophisticated music that was happening at the time of the Pilgrims. And so what we found was a collection of really, really wonderful pieces from the early 18th century. And those pieces, there was a tradition in the United States which was called shape note singing. Shape note singing was a way to sing hymns, but the notation was not the typical notation that Beethoven or Bach or Mozart would have used. It actually had the heads of notes would either be triangular or square or round or something like that. And that's how you knew where you were in the music. Not very, very easy to read for someone who's been trained on traditional notation. But what we did, we found an arrangement by Alice Parker. She's a wonderful, she's probably in her 90s now, but she has worked to bring American music to the fore in a number of different ways, collaborating with Robert Shaw, the great conductor of the Atlantic Symphony Orchestra, and other people to bring American music to the front. And so this is a collection of the first piece that we're doing is a collection of 13 shape note hymns that are accompanied by brass quartet and harp. And it's really turned out to be something really quite fantastic because it's kind of raw in its making, but at the same time, uplifting things with traditional texts, sacred texts.
But continue.
And then the second piece is probably the one that I might be the most excited about because one of the things that an ensemble might do, an orchestra, a band, a jazz band, a chorus, or whatever, is to commission a piece of music that might be appropriate for what you're trying to do. And so back in 2019, we started conversations with Clifton J. Noble, Jr., who's a Western Massachusetts composer. And he had worked with us previously on we did the Mozart Requiem because one of the things that we do is really to present larger works like the Brahms Requiem, the Mozart Requiem, the Vivaldi Gloria, really pieces that are lengthy and really quite difficult at the same time. And so he had written a piece that we paired with the Mozart Requiem that worked really, really well. And so we approached him to write a piece of music that would be appropriate for the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Pilgrims, intended to be performed last year in 2020. But of course that didn't happen. But the highlight of the piece is that in working with Jerry Clifton Noble, we were able to agree upon a text that he might set. And so the first governor of Massachusetts was William Bradford. Curiously enough, my name is William Bradford Richter. Okay, and so it was interesting for me that we would take the music, the writings of him, and this, and so there's a poem that he wrote as well as. And as well as some of his other writings that Jerry Noble took to set to this wonderful thing. The neat part is that it's also scored for four brass players, harp, and piano. So it's like you're not hiring a wholly different orchestra or something like that. It's the same orchestra. And so he fashioned this piece to be about 15 minutes in length on the writings of William Bradford. And that's for me is really great. Groups don't have an opportunity necessarily to commission works because it's costly. But this will be the world premiere of this work that we're performing on the 23rd and 24th of October.
What does it mean to be able to return to the performance stage post pandemic to you? And what are you hearing from the chorus?
Well, there's a lot of mixed, okay, because we are still going to be using all the precautions that we possibly can. We're 3 feet separated. Everybody is masked, and we're asking that everybody that attends the rehearsals be vaccinated, and that's only for precautionary purposes. But coming back after being away so long, I get choked up every time I hear them because it's like I said, it's the most beautiful sound on earth. And there are very, very dedicated people who are dedicated to this organization and to the music that we make, and also to share this this joy that we have with the public.
So I would ask you this now: have you ever performed at the St. Bonaventure Parish previously? Is that your home, or is this new to the choral group?
We have performed in a number of different places, but St. Bonaventure's Parish out in Manomet is really a gorgeous space. Acoustically, it's really, really wonderful. In other words, the chorus can sing. They sound good to themselves, and they sound good to the congregation or to the audience. It's about the right size for us. It can seat for 550 people, which is what we'll typically we have attracted in previous years. And so I think that we're probably at about 6 or 7 years of being there, because it's also very, very accessible. There's a huge parking lot. It's not up a bunch of stairs, but for many years we were at the Church of the Pilgrimage, which was downtown in Plymouth, and that's on a hill. There's another church in the square. There is no parking anywhere available. It was really hard with lots of stairs and things like that. So this is a really, for us, it's a wonderful venue, and the parish is very, very welcoming to us to be able to do our performances there.
And you were talking about, you know, being able to have a piece that's commissioned or the world premiere of this commission. What does the choral group normally? What do you normally, sing? What are some of the pieces that you normally do? Is it seasonal, or is this different for your group?
This is an unusual year, because we wanted very much to get this performance in, because we weren't able to do it last year. Yeah. But typically we'll do lighter and some Christmas music in the fall. And then typically in the spring, we'll take on a larger work. And once again, what I mean by that is something with orchestra and with chorus and it could be in another language. It could be, but usually those are pieces of music that would be 45 minutes to an hour long, major works. And that's, so we have sort of two different things we're doing. This year, our focus is significantly different, because we'll do this performance in October. We're going to come jump right back in, so we can still do a Christmas program, with pieces that we've done in the past that are sort of like our favorites from the past. And then in the spring, instead of doing a major work, because this thing that we're doing with the Alice Parker and Noble pieces might look like major works, we were in March of last year, of 2020, we were in preparation for a program which was called A Woman's Voice. And basically that was pieces of music by women composers or women authors or poets, and basically giving credit to the fact that not all great music was written by dead old white guys. Okay. Right. So there's a lot of great music out there, and you know, Elizabeth Barrett Browning and great poets and things like that. So that's what we'll do in the spring, is we're going to rekindle that program that we were probably a third or a half of the way into preparing for spring of 2022.
So basically, and just so folks who don't understand when it comes to the chorus or choral groups, it is very seasonal for you. You pick and choose your pieces for your performances for each season, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. But we also have to try to have a vision. We have to try to have an idea of what it is that we might do this year and next year, and possibly even 2 or 3 years after that, so that we know what is challenging and rewarding for our group individually. Because really, for me, it's great to have an audience come, and I do hope that we have a great audience for these performances in October. But I serve also another audience, and the other audience is the singers in the group itself, and they are at least as important, if not more important, to me, because those are the people who invest all the time. And I say, oh, well, we rehearse for 2 hours on Monday nights. There are people in the group that are investing 20 hours a week into this group. And that's you can't make that stuff up. It's great.
And if you are just tuning in, you are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And we are rounding the bend for the final turn, the final few minutes, as we are privileged to be talking with the Pilgrim Festival Chorus founding artistic director and conductor, Bill Richter. And he's talking with us about the upcoming performance that's going to be taking place on October 23rd, 7:30 p.m. start, and then on October 24th, the following day, a 4 p.m. start. This is at St. Bonaventure's Parish, 803 State Road in Plymouth. If you want to find out more information about how to get tickets and more, maybe you're somebody who wants to get involved with the chorus, pilgrimfestivalchorus.org. Again, pilgrimfestivalchorus.org. So I want to, probably one of my final questions, and I know earlier I had asked you about what it means to be returning to be able to perform. What is it? What does it mean to not only you, but also your accompanist, Elizabeth, who is a part of this?
Well, actually, the interesting part is that Elizabeth and I have worked together as musicians for 35 years. She was the organist of the church where I was in Plymouth at the Church of the Pilgrimage for a very long time. And it was our idea to put this group together. And she has been the most wonderful partner in all of those years. And so to the two of us, it's really a labor of love. It really is. It's something that we do because we have a passion for choral music. We have a passion for people, and we have a passion for finding really great ways to bring interesting music to our audiences.
Anything I haven't asked you in regards to the upcoming performance of Pilgrim Journey, Songs of Faith and Courage? Anything we want to make sure that we don't omit from our conversation here?
Well, only that we would ask that folks that come to the performance give us lots of money. I didn't say that. I'm kidding. I'm joking. Okay. No, but the folks that come to the performance, if you would be masked, that would be really great, because we are trying to be as safe as possible. And all of our singers will be masked. And that poses some difficulties. I'm sorry. Try you know, just talking with a mask on. It is difficult. Singing with a mask on is equally as difficult. But we want everyone in the group to be safe and everyone in the audience to be safe.
And just I also, one other little piece of bit. If folks want to reserve tickets, I believe they can call Hannah Woodbury, 781-834-8601. Again, that number, 781-834-8601. And as was described earlier, this is a beautiful church, and you said the acoustics are fantastic. So this is seats of over 500 people.
Yep. It's a large Catholic church, right in Manomet.
I've done a lot of theater over the years, and I don't know if this is apropos to say, but to you and all of your performers, break a leg, or
thank you,
or good luck. I hope it goes well. And if you are going to be doing a quick turnaround to be doing some kind of a holiday event, there is a wide open door for you to walk right through, Bill, and talk a little bit about what's going on. And if you want to bring Elizabeth in, because I know you're both the artistic directors, sure. Or even maybe if you want to bring any of the performers, and we can have a nice conversation about the upcoming performances.
We'd love to do that. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Excellent. We've been privileged to talk a little bit about the upcoming performance of Pilgrim Journey, Songs of Faith and Courage. This is taking place on October 23rd and October 24th. If you want to find out more information, pilgrimfestivalchorus.org. And we've been privileged to be speaking with Mr. Richter, Bill Richter, who is the founding artistic director and conductor. We are going to say goodbye to you for this evening. I know, but fear not. We will return next week at 6:15 p.m. Until then, have a great evening.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD, streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
On the hour, sponsored by Dell Small Business.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. In Chicago, a small plane crashes in a Southern California neighborhood is heard on live ATC.
Tower, an aircraft has crashed about a half mile in front of us into the houses.
CBS's Anthony.